Feeney for the Bowling Green Immigrant Oral History Project. It is August 25th, 1998, and we're doing this interview in Barnes & Noble Cafe.
Our fun is late.
And we will hear background noise from the cafe. I just wanted to make a note of that in the beginning.
Yeah, let's just make them.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to start by asking you about your homeland, your hometown, what you consider home.
Well, Pismo Beach, mainly.
When did you move there?
Well, it was, let's see, 80, maybe 86 stuff. My parents owned a home there before, but I never lived there permanently. It was just visiting, more likely like a vacation home. And then around that time, when I went there right after high school, stayed there for maybe a year and a half, then followed my older brother to Nashville, who was going to school.
Okay.
He had just switched school from Arizona to Tennessee, so.
And your home, you were born where?
I was born in Syria, but I'm also Palestinian by parents. You know.
Where did you spend your younger years?
Well, in Kuwait. My dad had a job with the Ministry of Education in Kuwait, plus he was a businessman there. He had business interests in there, in that region, in that area. And I lived there. I went to middle school and high school there. And right after high school, I came to the United States, you know, where my older brother was already, you know, living here for at least 2 years. No, he was living here for like, oh gosh, like 6 years permanently, so.
And now you're a permanent citizen?
I'm an American.
Of the United States.
Right.
Did you ever live in Palestine?
No, actually, but that's by parentship, you know, you belong where your parents are, even if you have not been there. But my parents were born and raised in Palestine.
So you've been in the United States since the late 80s or the mid-80s?
Yeah, something like that, you know. We did visit like a couple times before I permanently moved here after high school, but...
When you moved to Bowling Green, what brought you to Bowling Green specifically?
Well, I went to Belmont College in Nashville for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, you know. And then I switched to Western.
What did you study at Western?
Hotel, restaurant, tourism management, and a minor in business administration.
Okay. When you first moved to Bowling Green, or to this region of the United States, did you find it different from where you were used to living?
Yeah, very different. I was raised in the city, so I'm from the city, mostly, and it's kind of different.
What kind of things stand out in your mind that...
Well, for starters, when I came here, I had some difficulty understanding what people were saying. There were a lot of clear people, you know, speaking clearly, but a lot of people were speaking with very heavy country accents, and I had to get used to it before I could really comprehend what they were saying to me and stuff. That's one of the things. Plus the weather is different, it's humid, and it's very changing all the time.
Okay. Your story is a little more unusual. Like a lot of the questions I tend to ask would be, you know, how did you first find it moving here, immigrating here, moving here? What are some of the major differences you found here compared to when you were growing up as a child?
Here, you know, just life in general, people have a whole lot more bills, you know. They work a whole lot more hours. They don't... overseas people socialize a whole lot more. They have more time to socialize than over here. That's one of the main things I noticed. Plus, there's just differences in, you know, the traffic laws and other laws, and, you know.
Well, have you run into any difficulties or any things that you...
In Bowling Green, no, not really. It's very easy going town, actually. You know, it's I come, you know, from Pismo Beach, which is also kind of like a quiet town in California and peaceful and stuff. And Bowling Green is kind of like that too, except just the weather is very different, you know. And maybe things are just a little slower here, the life pace is.
Okay. Now, have you found a kind of a community that you've built up here? Or do you have friends or family here?
I have a lot of friends here. I have a cousin in Paducah, Kentucky, actually, and who owns a construction company. And I have made a lot of friends in Bowling Green and other areas.
Where are your parents living now?
Well, they live, they have different residences, so they don't have one in particular, but my dad still owns some interest in Kuwait. He has some business interest, and he has business interest in Syria, so he owns a home there, and we own a home in Syria, in California.
Okay.
So they kind of hop around, you know.
Okay. Is there a large community of Palestinians or Kuwaiti? Would it be Kuwaiti?
No,
or
I was considered a foreigner over there.
Oh, you were?
Yeah. Anybody who's not Kuwaiti is a foreigner there.
Okay. Is there a community of, I guess, Middle Eastern community here in Bowling Green?
There is, but it's very, very quantitative. It's very numbered, you know. It's like the number is very small. Most of them are students, so there's really no cohesiveness, you know, or anything like that, as you might say with families can be.
Mm-hmm.
But there is in Pismo Beach and, of course, California, full of them.
Well, after you finish your degree,
mm-hmm.
Why have you decided to stay in Bowling Green?
Well, originally I did not. I was going to move. I've always wanted to have a business of my own, especially a Mediterranean restaurant chain. I wanted to be one of the first ones to launch one because there's not that many in the United States. And I was going to move to Pismo Beach back home and start the business there. But the day after I graduated was that soon that the opportunity came along, and so I just seized it and studied the area around here. And I know that Bowling Green is a testing market for a lot of restaurant chains, so I figured I might as well can test my concept over here first.
Okay. So how have you set up your business? What type of food? How did you decide on what type of food to serve?
Well, it's. I decided on food. I'm not. I didn't try to be fast food, and I didn't want to be fine dining. I wanted to be somewhere in the middle, more like along the lines of casual dining, but with the prices being closer maybe to between casual dinings and fast food, a little cheaper than casual dining, you know. And I wanted stuff that would be healthy, and that's why I used like very healthy cooking methods. I only fry one item out of my home menu. The food particularly, I don't want anything very authentic, because most people in the United States, from what I experienced, they don't like too much spicy food, you know. They want a hint of maybe spice in there, you know, but not too much, and they'd rather, you know, they don't really like bland food either, you know. So I made my food somewhere along those lines too.
Okay, yeah, I have a lot of questions I want to ask you about your food, because, well, first of all, have you always cooked? Where did you learn to cook?
On my own.
On your own?
Yeah, when I left home, I never knew how to do anything, because we always had housekeepers at the home, and I just got tired of eating different foods here, and one day I decided I was going to do a homemade meal. And I think I burnt the first one, or, you know, it was really mushy rice and everything else, but I ate it anyway, you know. And from there on, I just started, like, experimenting, and also by going to Western, you know, I learned a lot of techniques and methods of cooking, you know, and And then once I got a down pat, and you know, it was easier. And then also by coming to Barnes and Noble, looking at some books like Mediterranean cooking and stuff, I learned some techniques that I used to watch my mom sometimes do them, but I never comprehended what she was doing or why the reason she was doing these things. So I just kind of like, you know, figured it out. And then, you know, just for the last 2 years, maybe, you know, I asked my mother like questions about how you do this and that, and but I always had my own way of cooking. Actually, it's much lighter than my mother's food.
Has your mother eaten your food?
Yeah, actually, she liked it. The only thing was for her, was she said it wasn't too authentic, you know.
Yeah, talk to me about authentic. First of all, what types of items do you serve in your restaurant?
Well, it's like maybe falafel, you know, hummus. That's authentic things, you know, and gyros. That's just the Greek name for the Mediterranean. You can call prime rib on a spit. Gyros is the Greek name for it. And there is other things like shish kebabs and baklava for dessert, and namura, and salads, of course, healthy salads. That's part of the Mediterranean diet, and kalamata olives and other things.
Okay. So we're talking, it's kind of a variety, a general variety from the a Mediterranean region?
Yeah, they crisscross. Like the gyros I get, it's really made by a Greek company, but the bread I use is more widely used in Middle Eastern countries than in Greece. However, they do use it in Greece too, but not on a large scale like they do in the Middle East. And the salad is very similar to the salad they make in Greece, but the sauce, I use the Mediterranean or the Middle Eastern sauce with the sandwich and everything else. And I also kind of like where you can fine-tune it, I change it a little bit also. I use more healthy ingredients, healthier, you know, it's a healthy sauce, but I kind of like modified it a little bit, made it even healthier, just to fit the taste.
Okay, how did you, what ingredients did you include or not include to make it healthy?
Well, one main ingredient is yogurt. Usually they use full-fat yogurt, you know. I use 99% fat-free yogurt, so it's kind of light, you know. And that's one of the things. And the Greek one, it's called tzatziki. It's made from sour cream, which is, it's full of fat. And it's made from cucumbers, you know, very small cucumbers. So I know how sensitive people are to fat these days, and, you know, how health conscious they are and stuff. So I decided to use, like, to be as healthy, as health conscious as I can be, without compromising the taste of the food, which food should be enjoyed first before anything else.
Okay. Back to the concept of authenticity or traditional foods. What types of foods did you usually eat when you were growing up, or that your mother prepared or your housekeeper would prepare?
Well, dolmas is my favorite, actually, kind of food. Stuffed grape leaves and stuffed zucchini and stuffed peppers and that kind of stuff. And they use a lot of rice overseas, you know, and rice maybe in vegetables too, and with meat and chicken, all kind of stuff.
And what about spices or seasoning?
Yeah, they use spices and seasoning whole lot more than in the United States.
What were some of the, maybe, say, signature spices that you grew up with?
Cumin is one of them, curry, you know, turmeric, that's one of them too. And there is some spices that you probably won't be, you've never heard of, like sumac, and it's za'atar, and there's, za'atar is oregano, actually, in the United States, but za'atar is a much different form of it. And there's basil, maybe, black peppers, dried lemon, you know, and also cardamom, that's big over there. Oh, and saffron, definitely saffron.
So how do you negotiate what did you think about when you were negotiating how you would prepare and serve food here in the States, or here in Bowling Green, compared to what you were used to as what you identified as Middle Eastern or Mediterranean?
Well, the only person I really negotiated with was myself,
yeah.
You know, decided on. But just from my own experience, I cooked a lot, and, you know, I have a lot of, most of my friends are Americans, and so they've tried my food, and they really like it, but my food is modified that from my, what my mother used to cook, or what they still cook overseas, and they like it a lot. And I've tested before I opened the restaurant. I have a couple friends that I tested on a lot, and I told them I wasn't gonna give them free samples unless they give me their really true opinions with that and compliments. And they did critique, you know, everything I did and stuff, and that helped me a lot, you know.
So what did you find that you changed the most?
The spices blend, you know, that's the most thing, you know. People don't, I don't use any oil in my cooking, barely any, you know. I use oil, which is olive oil, which is really good for your health, actually. And lemon juice and vinegar, that's, and garlic, that's all good for you. And but I just kind of like shied away from using too much spices. I've seen, also I've went to several restaurants, like in Nashville, Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, however you want to call it. And I've noticed, like, maybe there was about 20 attempts of restaurant that failed in Nashville, and you know, before some of them actually succeeded. And I noticed, you know, different ones, what they did right, what they did wrong, stuff like that. But I also had to take into consideration where I'm living, where I was gonna start my business, and what really what level are people on actually as far as knowing Mediterranean food where I was gonna launch my business. So Bowling Green, you know, it's not a big city, not as big, you know, as Nashville and stuff, so, but there's still a lot of people, actually, who know about Mediterranean food, been exposed to, maybe from traveling to Florida, Nashville, other areas, and, but for also a lot of, a large number of people, they haven't, so I had to do something like, to get the point across to them, actually to get them to try it, you know. So I started with the names, that's the first thing. I called the gyros, which is called shawarma actually in Arabic, and a lot of the Middle Eastern restaurants, that's what they call it. I called it gyros, which is the recognizable name for it in the United States. Other things like meatloaf, we call it kofta actually, and other restaurants use kofta name here. If I put kofta on my menu, probably a lot of people would be kind of skeptical about, you know, actually trying the food. So I use the word meatloaf, which they can identify with, relate to. You know, I use stuff like, you know, the way I describe my falafel, you know, I describe them as maybe hush puppies, you know, something people can relate to. A lot of things like shish kebabs, that's something people, a lot of people actually know, you know, that I didn't need to. But like something like hummus, you know, it's a garbanzo bean dip, you know. Just things that, terms, you know, and I named my menu especially on things like, I divide my menu by platter, sandwich, or combo. All in, ending with catchy names, you know, catchy terms people are used to hearing combo, you know what I'm saying? That kind of thing. So, and also from my own education at Westland, you know, I designed menus before and stuff, and I know what words to use and stuff like that. So, the menu part took me a long time to devise, and I tested for about 6 months before I opened the restaurant on the food too.
So, the distinction Middle Eastern or Mediterranean, do you have a preference? Or how you describe your food?
I would call it, it's more like, it's more, I would say it's Greek, Middle Eastern, but the way it's presented presented more to accommodate Americans than people from those regions, the Mediterranean.
So if I were to travel in different regions of the Mediterranean, I would run into these are items that I
they'll have it. It just probably would be more authentic as far as spices. They might have more olives, more spices, made in a different way, maybe made with items you have not experienced before. So I just kind of like the way I present my food here and approach people is very close to what Americans are used to, with that actually Americanizing my food. You know, that's one thing I wasn't gonna do, is Americanize it, you know, or authenticize it a lot either. So I wanted somewhere in the middle.
Okay. Right. Do you ever prepare anything special for any customers who are, or
yeah,
Middle Eastern customers?
Oh yeah, actually yeah. A lot of them, they want something like falafel on the side by itself, or then they want a little bit more spices and stuff like that. They want a little bit more sauce, you know, just different things like that, you know. We're used to serve food in a different way, you know, than I usually serve it here.
How would you serve it?
Well, just there's certain items that go together, you know. Over there, like hummus, tabbouleh, falafel, and maybe baba ganoush, or there's another one, tabbal, which is similar to baba ganoush, but it's not the same. And they serve those items, and they call them meza. Meza means appetizer. They serve them more as an appetizer rather than as like a meal. Sometimes they also serve them like a meal. But for example, they have one dish, it's hummus with shawarma on top of it, which is called gyros in the United States.
With what on top of it?
Gyros.
Mm-hmm.
Shredded gyros.
Shredded.
Right, but actually it's not the same that they sell here in the United States. It's made with a whole lot more spices, and it's made from 100% lamb, you know. But as far as the one I use, and the one that is actually available in the United States, that is made commercially, to be used commercially, is mostly beef, and maybe 15%, 20% lamb. But a lot of restaurants, actually, Middle Eastern restaurants, they just get their own lamb meat, and they stack it up on a stick, and to make it the authentic way. But also, you know, I mean, in that way, you gotta take into consideration your customers, what they, how they actually approach the food, if they really like that kind of food, you know. A lot of people, I've seen a lot of restaurant owners make a mistake of insisting on keeping everything so authentic in their menu, the names, everything, that they actually lose out on a lot of customers, because there's a lot of customers who will be skeptical. You don't normally eat something you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a lot of people, you know, I think in the United States or in this region, you know, they're very skeptical, you know. So the best way is to maybe modify the way you present it, you know, with terms that they can relate to. And you gotta modify also the way it tastes, you know, the way it's presented on a plate.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's set up, like overseas, when we serve rice, you don't get bread with it. You know, it's either one of the two, because it's all carbohydrates, you know. Over here, bread is the main item. You gotta have bread, just everything, you know. Overseas, salads don't usually get bread with them, you know. You eat salad without bread. Over here, it's a given thing, you know. So you gotta modify that.
Well, at this point, we need to stop this part of the interview, and we'll pick it up at a different time.
Okay.
But I thank you very much, and we will continue it later.
Cool.
Okay, it's September 23rd, 1998, and this is Luann Johnson, and I'm doing a follow-up interview with Erfan Hatini, in the Whole Earth Grocery at Hattini's Mediterranean Deli. It is located within the grocery itself. How are you doing today,
Aaron? Oh, great. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? You're feeling better since your last interview.
Yeah, I can breathe.
Okay. I spent a lot of time talking with you last time about food and your restaurants and your plans with the business. And I just wanted to follow up by talking a little bit about what your goals and your plans for having a family or staying in the States are. What are your plans?
Well, my plans first to come to business right now, and Hattini's eventually is gonna have more than one just location, and probably in different states. Family, as far as family, probably will have family, but it won't be this year or next year. You know, it'll be a little bit down the road from now.
Okay. Would you stay in the Bowling Green area?
Oh, for the near future, yeah. That's where my center of business. I like Bowling Green, so it would not harm me to stay here.
Do you envision that once you do have a family, I guess, comparing how you grew up with how you live in America,
mm-hmm.
What are some of the values or customs or traditions that you would be sure to continue with your own family?
Well, one thing, I gotta keep the family like bilingual. They have to keep up, you know. Not only that, to remind them of their heritage, but also that will give them an advantage here in the United States to be bilingual. And values and customs, just like in any other good family, you know, they want their kids to grow up to with goals and careers, and you know, to be kind and be nice, and you know, kind of thing.
Okay. What other language would they speak? Arabic as well?
Arabic, yeah, probably Arabic. I probably would stress, you know, Spanish as well. You know.
Okay. Would you speak Arabic in the household as the first language, or?
Well, with kids, you have to, actually. You know, you have to, you know, from the very beginning, because they can learn English from school and the surroundings, since the majority in the United States are English speaking, so the kids will have no problem picking up English, you know. But, you know, once they're home, you know, the parents have to actually speak to them, you know, in Arabic or their native language, so that they'll pick it up too, you know.
Well, why do you think this would give them an advantage in America?
Well, we'll give them different perspective on life, you know. You can see things from one angle, but with when you're it just kind of like makes you versatile, you know, and it is an advantage.
Yeah, and how is it important to you from a heritage point of view?
Well, for one thing, you know, it helps, you know, communicate. Probably if I have people from who speak Arabic, customers, you know, who can speak good in English or something like that, we can still communicate. And once, you know, you learn a foreign language, it can kind of like help other people probably who can't speak very good English or can't communicate. It kind of like opens your horizon, and you kind of like, even if the other person can't really express himself very good, but you kind of like you'd be able to infer what they're trying to express. And that's one of the advantages. Plus, it makes it a whole lot easier for you to pick up even a third and a fourth language, you know. And the only thing about it, though, you know, you could, you know, when I speak with my parents or something, I switch between English and Arabic, you know, and they're mixed. One word is Arabic, one word is English. I just mix them up naturally without even thinking about it, you know, and it makes it kind of funny, you know.
So what other traditions or beliefs would you keep alive within your family?
Well, the family has to be coherent. That's one value, you know. My family is a very tight family. We're always been very close, and, you know, that's something people, you know, families need to keep within them.
What kinds of things keep you, do you feel helped keep you that close?
Well, I'm always in touch with my family. And one of the other things, you know, families overseas do is, like, they help each other out. Like, you know, usually the older brothers or sister, excuse me, who have jobs, you know, they'll help send their younger brothers to college and pay for that college, actually. You know what I'm saying? And, of course, the parents pay for the first child, the oldest one and stuff. But then once the oldest one graduate and, you know, and get a job or something like that, they all pitch in to help their other brother maybe go to college. Education is very important. It's like, and with education, it's like food and water to us, so.
What, is there a preference to the type of education?
Yeah, college degree, you know, sciences usually, and doctors, engineers, lawyers, that kind of thing, dentists.
Now, if there were something that you would frown down upon, say your son or daughter came home and wanted to study a certain subject, what subject would that be that would be less approving than say, them wanting to go to medical school?
Well, it's, you know, things maybe like, you know, music or things like philosophy or something like that. I would not choose for my children, you know, what they want to study, but I would definitely try to influence them from the very beginning, try to help them, like, find a career. But then, you know, I mean, my parents, you know, they suggested I go to dentistry school and stuff like that, you know. But I didn't, you know, I chose my own career for me, you know, and it worked out just fine, you know. But as long as it's something that is practical, can, you know, you can, you know, use it to earn a living or a livelihood, you know, something that will be a stepping stone to something better, you know. Because I've seen it, like, a lot of people with degrees, like, yes, that's what they like, philosophy or something else, but they also, the demand for it is limited, so people have to think both logically and emotionally wise, you know, by picking up what they want from college, you know, whatever study, but they have to be practical and logical by assessing, actually, if they're going to be able to actually make a career and actually earn money from that degree they get.
Okay. What religious traditions do you practice and follow?
I'm a Muslim. I'm from the Muslim faith.
Okay. Is that, how do you practice that here daily? In
it's five prayers a day. You know, just there is a mosque, which is equivalent to a church, and there's I think they meet in Bowling Green at Western Kentucky University, but in Nashville there's three mosques, and there is Islamic school, and there is two celebrations. One's called the what is it called? The fast breaking of Eid, and the other is the pilgrimage Eid, or after the pilgrimage sacrifice.
Ramadan
is the fast month, and there is Eid after it. It's called usually another term, the small one celebration, and there is the bigger one is after the pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. And those are the two main ones we celebrate, and there is also the birth of the Prophet Muhammad, but that's we celebrate that to a lesser extent. You know, we recognize it, we have a day off, but the first two ones, you know, are the main ones we have.
Is it pretty easy to be able to practice your holidays or observe your holidays working within American structure?
Yeah, in the United States, yeah. I've been, you know, especially being self-employed, I can dictate, you know, myself. But once you talk to the employers, the people I work with, once I talk to them and I had to do this, I had to do that, they were understanding, yeah. They'll facilitate, accommodate, you know, your faith and let you practice it.
Are there any other, either, not so much even difficulties, but other things that you take in that maybe the average American does not take into consideration?
Can you exemplify?
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase it. Have you found any other I guess, difficulties just interacting with friends and
well,
people in America?
Recently, no. I mean, I've been in the United States for 12 years, and I saw that light.
Yeah, it's side B, and we're continuing our interview with Irfan Hussaini. It is September 23rd, 1998, and I was trying to ask you questions about the Islamic faith,
mm-hmm.
so I was doing it quite inarticulately. I guess what I'm really just trying to ask is, have you run into any obstacles or any difficulties practicing your faith while you've lived in America?
Actually, no, except when it's fasting month, when I'm fasting but everybody else is eating, and kind of makes it kind of tempting. But actually, no, it's just kind of, it's a process of adjustment. You can adjust whatever you want, you know, whatever you are, if you have strong faith. So
I guess I'm not implying there isn't a significant Muslim community in America.
Oh yeah.
But I just on an everyday level when on an everyday level, I would imagine that the majority of people you interact with are not Islamic.
Yeah, so they're Christians, you know, mostly, of course.
So maybe there wouldn't be such a tight-knit community or such a supportive community of...
Actually, no. Actually, a lot of my friends, you know, they're religious. They're Christians, and they're religious, too. Very religious, just like I am, you know. But, you know, actually, they support me, and I support them, you know. It's just... It goes back to the individual, actually.
Have you found a lot of common ground between two faiths?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, it came from the same divine source, you know, so it's the same thing. Love your neighbor, you know, love your family, that kind of thing, you know. And worship God, of course, you know. Don't love money, you know, that kind of thing. Don't get drunk, that kind of thing.
Okay. So that would be an important aspect of your family life when you do start a family.
Yeah, oh yeah.
What kind of traditions mark certain parts of, I guess, the life process within the Islamic faith? Like, are there rituals or holidays or traditions around birth and what are marriage is like?
Well, marriage, for the most part, there is no premarital sex between men and women. Society, but there is something called engagement. You know, when you like somebody, you just go to their parents and see if you like to be engaged, you know, or if it works out, you get engaged for maybe a year, at which that time, you know, you study the other person and they study, you know, you to make sure that, you know, will work out. After that, you can proceed with marriage or you can break it off. But that would be considered the dating period. But also there's, of course, no sex, premarital sex or touching or, you know, probably, yeah, hold hands, stuff like that, but nothing, you know, sexual, you know, not even by Bill Clinton's definition, you know.
Well, what about after you're married and you have children, what types of traditions or customs?
Well, usually, see, we usually like, for example, when they have first the marriage part, you know, the husband, the groom has to pay for everything, usually. And he has to give his bride a whole set of gold, like earrings, everything, and usually it's in a big hotel with, you know, with open buffet for everybody, and then he's got to give her something we call an English dowry, or kind of like it's a gift, you know, kind of like give her money to buy new clothes for her and stuff. And there's usually always in marriage in Islamic countries or Islamic tradition where the husband and the wife, they have to sign something called like a contract, where in case of a divorce, the wife will get a set amount, you know what I'm saying? That'll be kind of like prenup, you know, something like that. You can call it like that. But that's, they call it the mu'ajjal, which means the deferred, you know. and that just, of course, if there's any kind of adultery, you know, on any side, there won't be, that would be, you know, revoked, you know, but that's basically, and then, you know, everybody at the wedding party gives the groom and bride, you know, gifts and stuff, and they usually go for on a honeymoon for a whole month, somewhere real nice and stuff, and you know, when people, you know, have kids, they have baby showers, of course, and of course kids are circumcised in Muslim traditions from the very young age, maybe a year old or a year and a half, and you know, there's baby showers, you know. There's, of course, just like when a pregnant woman delivers, you know, there's gifts and all that kind of stuff, and usually, you know, usually the babies, you know, they buy them like little gold piece with God's name on it or something like that, you know, just little nasty stuff.
Would you want to have a traditional wedding when you do get married?
Yeah, I would, and but I'll probably throw a twist in it too, you know, knowing me. I always like to throw my own twist in things, and...
Would you be married in the States, or would you go...
Oh, no, in the States. You know, there's a lot of Muslims in the United States, and there's also a lot of Arab Americans in the United States, so I don't have to go anywhere, you know.
I just meant to be around family, or...
Sure. Well, my family is mostly, you know, here, my immediate family, you know, so I probably, you know, going to be somebody from the United States, you know.
Okay. Well, I think I also wanted to ask you, is there any beyond religious or other customary traditions that you would like to someday pass on to your children or your grandchildren? Are there any stories or tales that you remember as a child that you would tell your children and that you would want to pass on as a tradition to them?
Well, I'll have to jog my memory a little bit for that, you
Nothing
know.
Nothing just pops into mind.
Well, don't drive without a driver's license. You know,
I bet there's a whole
teenager.
Story behind that.
Yeah, when you're a teenager. And when you do, try not to wreck the car, you know. And
personal experience, everyone?
Yeah, like 3-4 times, you know. And, you know, and that cost my dad a lot of money, you know. That could keep on replacing cars, you know. And that's one thing. The other thing, you know, just to martial arts. They gotta know martial arts.
So that was important to you growing up?
Oh, yeah. All my family's like, you know, one brother's boxer, the other's martial artist. You know, plus in the, you know, a lot of, I guess in the Arabic tradition, we emphasize like sports, especially like martial arts, because of the flexibility and stuff. It's very famous. We're all like Bruce Lee nuts and stuff like that.
Okay, that's great. Is there anything you'd like to add or that we haven't talked about that you would like?
Well, I like my kids maybe to, you know, I like, you know, whenever I have kids, I like them to be involved with the religion from the very beginning, which I was, but then I wasn't to that extent, you know what I'm saying? And just recently I've been getting back in touch with it. But since, you know, if you start kids with very young age, you know, I like maybe to put them in an Islamic school from the very beginning, especially in the United States where, you know, the Muslims are not, of course, a majority. So for us to keep that tradition and to teach them, you know, to be close to the religion will be a little bit more challenging than overseas where, you know, and in an Islamic country where everybody, mostly a lot of people are Muslims and, you know, kids pick up things much easier, you know, but here you have to really, it's going to be a little challenging, but it could be done. You know, and I just like kids to be, you know, nice kids and, you know, be neat and clean and just teach them all, you know, what makes up a good family.
Okay.
you know.
What makes up a good family?
Well, first the, you know, the husband and the wife, they have to be in total harmony. That's one thing. And that usually, nothing stimulates harmony in a family more than religion, to be on the same sheet of music or the same level, you know, faith. And I think that's the most important thing in a family. And to treat each other, you know, from the very beginning with respect. And the kids will pick up on that, and they'll, you know, they'll treat their sisters with whoever, you know, other kids with the same values, and they to be always love each other, you know what I'm saying? That what keeps a family together. And for the parents to monitor their kids. You know, they have to monitor the kids not to give up or let go. And pretext that it's freedom or individual freedom, you know, or something, because freedom is a double sword, you know. It's good in its own parameters, you know, but once it overextends those parameters, can become a very dangerous thing.
All right.
You know, kids get into drugs and all kind of trouble, and they think they have the freedom to do anything they want.
Well, I don't have any more questions. Was there anything else you wanted to add or discuss?
Yeah, how my hair looks.
Your hair looks great. Well, I thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. I missed a cup of coffee from Barnes & Noble.